Dr. Gary Harlow.
The question of looking at randomism versus determinism has been a question that's gone back many, many years. In fact, you can go back and find quotes from Aristotle where he was made comments like, if you don't know what to do, then you ought to do the probable thing. Well, nowadays we have a very special meaning for probable. And when you look back in terms of what Aristotle said, there's some question as to what he meant. But at least he recognized that there are some things that occur more frequently than others. And as the years have progressed, people were pretty vague about the subject of quantifying what they meant by probable or possible or things like fate or luck or chance until really about the middle 1600s when a fellow named Cardan started trying to quantify what he meant by probable, possible, random, some of these terms. The real major contribution, though, came about 100 years later, around the middle 1750s. A guy named Laplace was asked questions, and primarily the reasons for the questions being asked was there were rich people that gambled a lot. And simply the question was, how can I maximize the money that I put up? And that's essentially where probability grew from. Determinism, on the other hand, I think most of us have a reasonable, good definition. Certainly if you look at different philosophers, there's a lot of argumentation about all of these words, which I'm not qualified to really go into. I think probably for this afternoon we don't really need to. Determinism basically means something to the effect that there's a cause that produces the outcome. So we'll take that as sort of a working definition. Probable, possible, some of those things you'll have to bear with me for a few minutes until I develop a little material before we get to that. Those things, as far as I'm concerned, have a very specific purpose, and they fit into an overall framework. And I think the most important concept when you come to looking at determining information is the concept of modeling. And if you want to be technical, maybe these things only apply to actual scientific investigations, but I think pretty much to some extent they apply to practically everything. What do you do when you do modeling? There's several different types of models. One's empirical, you have mechanistic models, then those things can be broken down into different classes, things like probabilistic, deterministic models, all sorts of different things. What do you do when you start? To start with, you have to have some connection with the real world. You have to look at real world data. Once you take that, then the next step in going from the real world data is to some kind of mathematical model. Actually, this whole process is what I'll call the modeling cycle. But in technical terms, that next little blob up there is where the actual modeling takes place. That's where you try and make certain statements about what's happened so that you get this real world data. And the process that goes on in between that, those two steps is an inductive process. For instance, an empirical model might be something to the effect that if you go out to Yellowstone National Park and you want to see Old Faithful, there's a sign posted and they give you sheets of paper that give you an empirical model as to the operation of Old Faithful. They say that if the last geyser lasted approximately 2 to 3 minutes, which is short, then the next one will occur in about 58 minutes, something like that. If the last geyser was a long one, say on the order of 3 to 4 minutes, then it'll take about an hour and a half before the next burst will occur. That's an empirical model. And practically everybody who goes there gets to see it at least once. We were there a couple summers ago and saw it, seemed like, every 15 minutes. So that's an empirical model. It's dealing with the real-world data. After you take the mathematical model, The next step is to proceed to mathematical predictions. It means you actually do something with what you've constructed. And that step is a deductive thing. Once you've given a certain set of postulates, then you simply crank through machinery. I'll give you a specific example here in a minute. After you have the mathematical predictions, you then have to come back to real-world predictions. You have to make interpretations of your mathematical statements. When you do algebra, X always means something. Usually people equate it to apples or pears or something. When you do some equation, you bring back the X into the real-world thing. The fellow that's running the grocery store could care less what X equals. He wants to know how many apples he's got by it. So you have to come from the predictions and the mathematical terminology back to the real world sense. And then finally, to complete one cycle, you have to check the real world predictions against real world data. And there's two processes there. One, you can check your model to see whether it's consistent. You know, if you start with a certain amount of data and you do all of this junk, and you come back and you don't predict what you started out with, and something's wrong. Got to do something to clean things up. That's one type of testing. Another type of testing falls more into the line of prediction, where you actually predict that this will be the outcome, at which case then you go and collect more data to see if your prediction really makes sense. Okay, I'll put that back on the screen in just a minute because I think it's very important. However, I want to give you a little example here of a modeling technique. Let's suppose that you looked at a clock on some given Sunday at noon, and then you read the clock every 12 hours after that. Okay? So let's say this coming Sunday, you go and you look at the clock, and then you read it every 12 hours after that, from now to eternity, or till something happens in between. Let's suppose the data looked like that. So the first case here, at time zero, so this is the noon on Sunday, the observation on the clock was 3. 12 hours later, the observation was 3. 24 hours later, the observation was 3, and so forth. So every time that you read this clock, it says 3. All right, that's data. We've collected data. Now the thing is, we want to make some kind of a model. All right, one thing you could do, this is all under the induction step, one possible choice for the model would be, I'll let CT represent clock time. You could say that the clock time was a constant 3, broken, not plugged in or something. It's always 3 o'clock. No matter what time you go to observe the clock, it's going to say 3 o'clock. The way most of the clocks in our building here is. So that's one model you could have. A second possibility would be something a little more elaborate, which would say that the clock time is equal to 3, plus some variable amount, and this jump, which means modulo 12, what you have to do is take the remainder of this quantity. So you take 3 plus x and divide it by 12, and whatever that remainder is, that cycles it around. That's where you do tell time anyway. So what this would say is that the clock functions properly. The only thing is it's 3 hours off. Instead of it being noon, when it's really noon, it says 3 o'clock. So when it's 3 o'clock, the clock would say 6, and so forth. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that it cycles around several times in 12 hours. So instead of going around once in 12 hours, it could go around any number of times, like maybe twice, or it's 3 times faster than it should be, something like that. There's all sorts of unlimited things you could do. You could also have a model where the clock time starts out at 3, but then it's all fouled up in some way. Maybe it speeds up for 3 hours and it slows down for 3 hours. Maybe it stops for a while. You could do almost anything.
all of that involves the inductive step of trying to guess what's going on with this clock. And at the surface, you have to decide what goes into this induction process. Obviously, most of us have enough faith in clocks, no matter how bad they are, to select this choice. We would say, well, the clock really runs properly, it's just that it's set 3 hours wrong. So whatever process you want to think about that goes into this induction, whether it's something you've actually observed or some mental presuppositions that you've made about the way clocks work, whatever you want to use, all of that goes into this inductive step to choose some model. Now then, what actually happens? Well, the deduction is to select one. So for instance, let's suppose we take that it's really working properly and it's only 3 hours off. The deduction step then, you can conclude from this model that there's a one-to-one correspondence between clock time and real time. If the clock really operates this way, you give me any time you want to and I can tell you what the clock time is going to be. You give me any clock time that's reasonable, and I can give you up to every 12 hours anyway, I can give you what the actual time should be. So assuming that this is a reasonable model, then the deduction step says there's a one-to-one correspondence between the clock time and the real time. So therefore, you have to come back to the terms where you test these things. And like I mentioned, the test can comprise two different things. One, the ability to explain the phenomenon. Secondly, prediction of new data. Well, in this case here, no matter what we chose up here, it would explain the phenomenon. That's such simple data. You could do anything, and you would be able to interpret or get back information that you started with. What would be important in this example is prediction of new data. And obviously, if you're going to check whether or not this clock is working properly, you wouldn't want to measure every 12 hours. You want to measure some intermittent times. So that's part of the reason for looking at these type of models. This type of a model would tell you, look, it's not enough to observe this thing every 12 hours. You can look at it in intermittent times. Okay, so then, let me just put the picture back up. I think, for the most part, there's a lot of different things that can be complained about in terms of this sketchy model of how the modeling process works, but I think for the most part, it captures all of the things that really go on when you model things. You can take any experimental, scientific fact, law, whatever that you want to pick on. Somebody first started looking at real world data in some sense. They made some guess as to the way things work, then made some mathematical predictions, made predictions of the real world type, and then you check. And you continually do that. Everything in science is in a continual state of flux. And oftentimes, I think we get the impression that there's certain laws that have been established by scientists that are absolute truths. And that's just not the case. Even the most fundamental thing in physics, where you have Newton's second law, F equals ma, says the force is equal to mass times acceleration. We take that as an absolute almost, and yet the first question someone asks is, well, what about friction? What about wind drag? What about this? What about that? And obviously you have to say, well, I haven't included that. Let me include that. As soon as you do that, someone else says, well, what about this? Well, I haven't included that. I got to do that. That's cycling around this cycle. Okay. Most important concept I think that you can get is that everything, in terms of at least scientific knowledge, may want to be more brazen and say every kind of knowledge, at least scientifically obeys this cycling process
Therefore, you cannot say absolutely for sure that once you've learned something, it's going to hold for all situations at all times. It just doesn't work that way. There's always more data coming in, more information. Things have to be updated. Later on, we'll look at some of the reasons why you want to do different types of modeling.
Okay, so that's modeling. In order to understand what probability and statistics have to do with modeling, I think first we need to look at some terms. And these are terms that are used just in the common vernacular. Almost everyone says things like, what's the odds of such and such happening, especially if you go to the racetrack or anything like that. You're interested in the odds of something occurring. Well, the odds, technical definition, the odds of an event A is the probability that A occurs divided by the probability that A does not occur.
You took a simple coin toss for the winning probability.
It depends on the question. It depends on what event A is. The odds that it comes up.
Oh, I see. The odds of A would be the odds that anything happens. But
right.
Wouldn't that always be 1? Yeah, I'm trying to set up a coin toss for that little equation.
Okay. Let's suppose you're only going to toss a coin once. What are the odds that it comes up heads? Probability that can occur is 1/2, assuming a fair coin and all that stuff. Comes up 1/2. The probability that it doesn't come up is 1/2. So the ratio, when you do your arithmetic, is 1. So the odds are 1 to 1. Okay? They're even. Yeah, see, that's what you want to play. If you can find a game that you can play when the odds are even, then it's to your advantage. There's no games, no gambling games in existence where the odds are even. I guess the closest thing is roulette. And if you only bet black and red, still, there's an equal number of black and red, I think. I think there's
one or two left over.
16 of each, but then there's a zero, which is green, and usually a double zero, which is green, and the house gets those. You cannot bet the green one. So actually, I think there's a probability of 2 out of 38 for the house. So when you go to Las Vegas or this other place over here, don't play roulette. You're going to lose. Every gambling game, you're going to lose. If you were going to win, this place has been staying in business. So you have the odds of something that's fair, then indeed the odds are 1 to 1. That's a technical sense. Most of the time we use it in a vernacular sense to say, but what's the odds of this happening? What we're really asking is, how much do you really think that's going to occur? We're not asking for, well, 1 to 3 or 1 to 4 or something like that. Same thing with random. Usually what we mean by random is something of the order haphazard, lacking aim. Randomly got up at such and such a time, did this at a random manner. Just didn't have any real direction. Chance means accidentally. It was just by chance that this guy ran over me the other day. It was all purely accidental. Those are the typical kinds of words that come into play. I'm sure you can think of others. Fate, luck, all sorts of different things. You could spend a lot of time just going over those. Now then, let me give you a definition which is contained in a reasonably standard probability book for random. Random phenomenon is an empirical phenomenon characterized by the property that under a given set of circumstances does not always lead to the same outcome, but to different outcomes in such a way that there is statistical regularity. The reason why I have underlined empirical and statistical is to accentuate the fact that there are two cases in this definition of random that are purely tied up with guess. When you build an empirical model, you just observe something, and it's usually very, very crude. Okay? Phenomenon is random. It's a very crude observation indicates these things. Second thing, statistical regularity. Statistics is a field that almost through and through is an inductive field. Induction means, to me, being a probabilist, almost purely guess. What you're trying to do is you're trying to guess the regularity of some event occurring. And there's all sorts of there's a big theory developed that gives you a systematic way of guessing, but it's still a guess. So tied in this definition, which is a reasonably well-taken definition for random, there's these two key things that indicate that there's a lot of guesswork involved in what you label as random. All right. Even so, when you actually get to probability theory, what is meant by random is something entirely different than either what we've had on this other sheet or what this is. All right. Now then, let me just start a little bit with probability theory. This is a mathematical sense. In probability, the first thing that you have is a probability space. It consists of three elements: omega, script B, and P. Omega is called the sample space. And if you were interested in the event of tossing a fair, well, it doesn't even have to be fair in this case. If you're interested in the event of flipping a coin twice, then omega, the sample space, indicates all the outcomes that could occur. Flip a coin twice, you could get two heads, a head and a tail, tail and a head, or two tails. So you list all outcomes. You flip a coin three times, and there's eight things you have to list. You flip it four times, there's 16. If you want to roll a die once, then omega has six things, 1 through 6. If you want to roll it twice, it's got 36, and so forth. The script B is called a sigma field. And for most cases that most people deal with, this script B is just all of the subsets of the omega. So in this case, there were four elements here. If you list all the subsets, there will be 16 subsets. That includes the empty set, and that includes the whole space itself. All right? The third thing is a probability measure. Most people, when they think of probability, they really only think of this P, which measures different events. In fact, let me give you a technical definition here, just to show you that mathematicians do something. Probability measure is a function which takes some set in this script B. So for this case, you might want to consider the set of just two heads. It assigns to that set, that's what that arrow means, some number between 0 and 1. And for every set in script B, it does that. That's the first thing. Secondly, it gives measure of 1 to the whole space. So you ask the question, what's the probability that everything will occur? Or anything possible, that's got to be 1. Secondly, this is a term here, or a condition. The only reason I put it up here is to indicate another thing in just a moment. It says you have a collection of sets which come from B. It could be finite, or it could be countable. For countable, we'll allow infinite. Such that they're disjoint, so that when you intersect two of them, you get the empty set. then you have this condition here. All that says is if you take the probability of a lot of sets, then all you have to do is add the probability of each set. The only purpose for us today in putting this condition here is that this structure is pretty well accepted by the majority of people that do probability. However, there's a reasonably substantial and growing group that says this condition here really doesn't make sense. For this reason, if you're going to talk about probability, and if you're going to ever make application, does it make sense to talk about an infinite number of things? Well, usually the answer that's given is something to the effect, well, if you want to consider an infinite number of things, by the time they've occurred, we'll all be dead and it won't matter anyhow. There may be some weight to that. In terms of the mathematical structure, whether you allow finite or countable limits to things that you can do. Okay. Now then, just quickly look at some of the more common ways that probability is defined. The real reason for having such a technical definition as this is so that it includes all of the common notions that everyone has about probability. If you don't include everything that people commonly hold probability to be, then you really don't have much of a structure to do anything. The important point for you to realize here is, in terms of this topic of randomism versus determinism, is that this is a mathematical construct, pure and simple. It has nothing to do with reality at all. I can go through and I don't have to talk about coins, I don't have to talk about dice, roulette wheels, or anything. That's purely a mathematical structure. Believe it or not, people even make money to study it. Okay. Common ways to define probability, P. First one's a classical definition. That's the one I think a lot of people are familiar with. It says if you want the probability of event A, you take the number of ways A can occur and divide by the number of possible outcomes. The question came up of flipping a coin. How many ways, and let's consider the event A to be the event that on one toss, head comes up. How many ways can heads come up? Only one. How many possible things can occur? Two. And you get heads or tails. So one divided by two, probability is a half. You want to look at throwing dice, if you want to learn to play craps or something. You throw two dice, the question might be, what's the probability of getting a seven? You list all possibilities, you'll find out there's six of them. Out of all the total possibilities of throwing two dice, there's 36, so 6 over 36 is 1/6. The probability of rolling a 7 is 1/6.
This assumes all the outcomes of the problem.
That's right. Implicit in this assumption is that all the outcomes are equally probable. That's implicit in this assumption. The question is whether or not that's reasonable. Second definition, or way that probability is defined, is called the frequency or statistical definition. And in this case, what you want to do to find the probability of event A is to count the number of times that A occurs in any trials and then divide by the number of trials. So for instance, you take a coin and you start flipping it. You flip it 10,000 times, and you record the number of times the heads come up, maybe 5,110. So you take 5,110 and you divide it by 10,000, and for 10,000 trials, this estimated probability is whatever that turns out to be, 0.511 or something.
Yeah, how come under frequency it doesn't simply say P and A in practice again? What?
Because it depends on the number of trials.
Oh.
You see, if you flip a coin 10,000 times, you might get one answer. If you flip it a million times, you might get something else. So it depends on the number of times that you flip it. That's a very real problem because you don't want to talk about probabilities being dependent on the number of times you flipped it. You'd like to think of a coin, especially if we generalize some concept of it being fair, you'd like to think of that being independent of the number of clips. So then what you have to do is do another mathematical trick, in which case you take a limit. Sometimes this limit exists, sometimes it doesn't. Whether it does or whether it doesn't, it's a very complicated thing to show that it even makes sense to talk about a limit in this sense. The problem you get into with the frequency definition is exactly the same problem that I mentioned when I had the very technical definition. You have to consider the number of trials going to infinity. Does that make sense? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. One other definition for probability, which actually in terms of applications may be the one that's used most frequently. It's called conditional probability. This is read the probability of event A, the vertical bar mean given event B. So for instance, when we were talking about flipping the coin, with this definition especially, you say the probability that you get a heads on one flip is one half. Implicitly, we've assumed that you've got a fair coin. So as a matter of fact, you could say the probability that you get a heads on one flip of a coin, given that it's a fair coin, is something. The way this is defined is the probability of A and B divided by the probability of B. The people who like to use this kind of a definition most, or really like to ride that definition, are the people that are very much into these things called subjective probability, which puts you back into the realm of inductive reasoning. Subjective things, if you read anything like Stoner's book, Newman's book, where he tries to quantify probabilities for certain events happening, like the destruction of Edom or the closing of the wall at the Golden Gate. Those things are pure out-and-out subjective probability. There is really no basis for it. And when you want to assign numbers to subjective events, it's a very difficult thing. We really don't have much insight into how to do that. Become a very big field in philosophy and psychology. Okay, all of those things, all of those different definitions are special cases of the general definition, but all of them still are nothing but a mathematical construct. Have nothing to do with whether or not something's really random. And in fact, when you do probability, the question of random is only an artificial term. It never comes up. You never even discuss things being random. It's only artificially generated. Primarily, it's used to help people conceptualize things, the same way we talk about randomly flipping a coin. It has nothing to do with mathematics. It's only a conceptual tool to help you figure out what's taking place. All right. The probability in statistics is nothing but modeling, and it's only a mathematical tool. It's only one of the tools, by the way, that's used in modeling. Physicists for years use differential equations. That's another tool. This is just one out of many tools. Then what are the uses? Well, first of all, you have things that conform to the mathematical structure, like flipping a coin. Even if you take a chunk out of a coin, most of the time, it's reasonable to assume it's going to turn up heads as likely as it is tails. Rolling dice, playing roulette, almost any board game, any kind of gambling game, they pretty much conform to the mathematical structure. That means they're all reasonably fair, things of that nature. Second class, when you really, and we start to really get into some of the more important usage, is when only broad results are desired. Quite often it's not very necessary to determine specific details. Geologists like to study the way that streams push particles around. If they wanted to consider the motion of one little pebble, they could. They have the machinery to do that. But if you're considering the way that the Mississippi River moves, they really don't care about a little piece of granite, what that does. So a probability model or statistical model is very useful in that kind of situation, because only the overall behavior is really what's desired. Complex phenomena. It breaks down into two cases. One, when you know everything. There are certain situations when you know everything there is to know about the way the process works, within reason, assuming we've learned a lot about through the modeling cycle. And yet there's just so many factors involved, it's just not practical to consider all of them. So therefore you use a probability model. Another case, which is the one that's highly debated, is when you have complex phenomenon and you don't know everything. Most illustrious example of that is the uncertainty principle, which basically or roughly says there's no way to determine position and momentum of atomic particles at the same time. Well, that is a probabilistic structure put on that problem. Is it useful? Yes, very much so, because it gives you insight into the structure of atomic physics. It's also very reliable, as far as we can tell to this point, in making predictions about the way things operate. Is there something inherent in the structure so that there is randomness there, or is it deterministic? Simply don't know at this point. Maybe you'll never know. Some people say that there is this randomness there. You have to use your probability model. Other people, can't remember their names right now, have come up with these theories that there's hidden variables involved that we really just haven't figured out what the process is yet. Highly debated. I don't want to go into it. If you want to ask questions, ask Dr. Newman. That's his field. It's easy to be a probabilist. You can make slams at everybody. It's hard to get back at you. Outcomes which are substantially deviate from an established frequency. Most common cases of that are with biological things. People like to build a big argument about evolution and its very random chance mutations, things of that nature. Actually, I've done very little study with probability models applied to biology. However, the things that are done are so crude that literally a high school student can understand the probability level involved. So, there's a lot of reasons for it. One, we don't have the probability machinery to satisfy those examples. Two, we don't understand the biology. Three, even if you understood both of them, how do you make the correlation? There's a lot of different factors there. The models are very crude. Therefore, when people make very dogmatic statements about things of this nature, you have to take them with a grain of salt. At least I do anyway. The fifth case, which really is somewhat different than some of these other things, occurs when you want to look at time and space dependent things, non-repetitive things, like what's the probability that somebody's going to wall up a golden gate. That's purely subjective. People don't make a practice of going around building walls, putting a gate in, and then proceeding to wall it up. You just don't have any way to check it. You can't check it statistically. You can't, it really doesn't make much sense to talk about it from a probabilistic viewpoint. It's all pure guesswork. Oftentimes, things of this nature are classified as random. And again, this goes back more to the vernacular definition in that what really occurs is something that's not expected. Something that's not expected. Guy builds a wall, the gate gets walled up. That's not expected, so therefore it's random. Alright, in terms of conclusions then, when you look at the scripture, I think there are some other things that can be said about
whether things are deterministic or random. In terms of science, I think you simply cannot say whether or not there is an inherent randomness in things. Just simply can't be done. Primarily because all of our ways of obtaining scientific knowledge is through this modeling process. It's under a continual state of flux. You always have to change. You always have to update. The more you learn, the more you refine. So you can't make absolute statements. People that are very dogmatic about using probability have admitted that there's absolutely no way you can determine whether an event is random, has inherent randomness, or just apparent randomness, or whether it's deterministic. So then what do you do? I think you have to look at the scriptures. There's some indications on the issue there. Just a few of the verses, I'll read them to you quickly. Proverbs 16, verse 1. To man belongs the plans of the heart, but from the Lord comes the reply of the tongue. Verse 4. The Lord works out everything for his own ends, even the wicked for a day of disaster. Verse 9. In his heart a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. Verse 33. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. So those things seem to make it pretty clear that there's very little that's left to chance. There's other passages. If you're interested, I can show you a few others. And I think once you look at God's providence, see how that comes into play, I think you have to conclude that there is very little that's left to chance. However, there's one verse that uses the word chance, and you have to look at that. It's in Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11. I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned. But time and chance happens to them all. What do you mean by time and chance? Well, obviously, there's some races that the guy who's supposed to win doesn't win. Some battles that the people who are supposed to win don't win. So obviously, just a very crude reading says there's sometimes when an unexpected event occurs. Does that mean there's inherent randomness? Again, you look at God's providence, most of the time you can say no. Mr. Taylor published, I've forgotten when, 2 or 3 years ago in the Biblical Bulletin, a little short thing called Luck, Chance, and Fate. He did a word study, looked into this to some extent, and he claimed that the word chance here really refers only to one event. That event is death. So all of these things leading up, it primarily is saying you really don't know when you're going to die. That's the way Mr. Taylor took it. Since I haven't had Hebrew, I'll let Dr. Newman argue that point. So then what kind of conclusions can you make? I think from a Christian perspective, first of all, you can say every phenomenon that occurs in nature, it's possible to conceive of it in purely a deterministic sense. A lot of people think that's really what occurs. There are a lot of situations where it's very useful to use a probability model. You cannot rule out the possibility that there are some things inherently random just from scientific investigation. When you come to the scriptures, I think it's very clear that there's almost nothing left to randomness. However, God really doesn't tell us much about the way that atomic physics works. Could very well be that he has allowed atomic physics to be inherently random. You just don't know. There are certain things that you don't know. Most things you can say for sure
I think, are deterministic. A few things, we have to be a little more careful. I guess that's primarily my position. Can't really think of anything else or questions now.
If you say that, would it follow that anything in the universe were truly random, then there's a possibility that anything may occur with that particular, let's say there was random, atomic physics was random, let's say the stars, the physical structure of stars was random, well then, there would be a possibility, wouldn't there, of all the particles in that star accelerating over to some spot like here in the Earth and burn it out and jump back to these stars and it looks like nothing happened. But we would be burning the cinder. I mean, there's a probabilities to those kind of things that happen, right? Even if it's super small.
When you start considering when you leave open the possibility for an inherent randomness, first of all, I think what you need to do is go back and look at why you came to that conclusion. What data did you look at? Why did you pick the random model? Why are you still satisfied that it works? There are a lot of probability models that limit things. For instance, if we're going to flip coins, let's say we're going to flip it twice. You are not going to even consider the probability of obtaining an edge. Well, if you consider things as everything being purely random, it's possible that when you flip a coin and let it land on the table, it's going to end on its edge. You have to, but most of us limit it. So when you talk about stars colliding and all that stuff, you have to go back and say, what limitations are there to these things from other facts that we've learned? Other than that, sure, there's always a small probability. Very important question is in terms of expected value. Let me just give you one quick illustration about expected value. Expected value just means what do you really expect to occur. Now with all of the business with nuclear energy being such a heated topic, people claim that such and such is reliable, say, to 10 to the minus 6. And most of that stuff is propaganda for one side or the other. Even when they use that number, it really doesn't have any meaning. For instance, the airport in Atlanta, Georgia, is so used that there's a plane that takes off and lands about every 3 to 4 seconds. Someone came up and estimated that the probability of having an in-air collision of either a plane coming up and one coming down or vice versa was something like 10 to the minus 6. Well, everybody sits back and says, well, gee, that'll never happen. And yet, the last few years, they've been averaging 10 to 12 crashes a year. Well, what's the problem? The problem is the probability of such an occurrence happening is 10 to the minus 6, but the number of occurrences is 10 to the 7th. Over a year, so therefore you multiply those two things together, you get 10. So there's other features to doing probability work other than just talking about randomness. You have to look at what conclusions you come up with. Part of it is expected value. You talk about a star colliding and hitting the Earth, have to take into consideration gravitational forces that we know a little bit about, have to take into consideration expected value given all these other things. I don't think you can rule it out completely, but from other things I would say that that's probably not a very good model.
Well, the only thing you might have mentioned that is because it seemed like if you say something random, there's a probability for something to happen that God wouldn't want to happen. That's when you get into, trouble. That allows any event that could ever conceivably take place to take place. And there must be some that God has, there are some that God has ordained that will not take place or that will take place.
Sure, the scriptures are very clear.
And you're stuck right there.
If fact, most of the things that we relate to, it's very clear that those are all determined. When you get into these molecules bouncing around, I'm not so sure whether that being inherently random limits what God can do in some sense. There's several verses that indicate that God has a little more wisdom than we do. Could very well be that he understands probability as well as we do and can take those things into consideration. I don't know. I don't think you can make a dogmatic statement from the scriptures that say one way or the other. I think the best position is to say, well, I personally, if I hadn't given this talk and you asked me on the street, I'd say I was an out-and-out, dyed-in-the-wool determinist. I wouldn't even allow the possibility to be open. I think, you know, to be reasonable about it, you have to say that there might be that possibility. Someone had their hand? Yeah.
A couple comments here. One is flipping a coin, and, you know, about ignoring the edge. I had something strange happen to me when I was in high school. Had three term paper topics I was going to choose between. Well, one for heads, one for tails, and I don't really want to do this, but I'll make an edge. Flip the coin. Believe it or not, I threw it near a stairway and the thing came down leaning on its edge. So I kept my promise and did that paper. But strange things happened. However, more to the point here of Mr. Sherman's remarks. One thing we need to realize is our probability when it's being used in many things, for instance, even in the whole question of gas and molecule action, is a model, not an observation. Therefore, you can predict, when you discuss the kinetic theory of gases and the kinetic theory of matter, you can predict that once in a while when you take a pot of water and you put it on a stove, it ought to just up and turn to ice occasionally. Say, because the molecules that have most of the heat ought to go off for some reason. They all just happen to be going that direction and leave behind the ones without it, which become ice. But that's never been observed. And therefore, what you're showing is that your model is predicting on a finer level than you've ever observed in your observations. You've therefore gone way beyond what your observations warrant. If it is truly random, those things will occur occasionally. But if it's not truly random, if it's operating by some law, hidden variable or something, then that may never occur, even though your probability would predict it. Now, another thing I saw in your remark is, if something is random, anything could happen. Well, you don't need to define randomness that way. In other words, that some star 8 light years away, if the thing is random, all those particles might come shooting over here at 5 times the speed of light, bounce off the Earth and go back into the thing, etc. It doesn't follow from that at all. If they're moving around randomly, they still may be subject to the laws of gravitation, and they still, which would limit what fraction can get away and things of that variety. And they're still going to be subject to perhaps special relativity, things like that, right? So that's just a problem of trying to define what random is.
I'm having a hard time understanding random, putting your model, if we are to observe real world data as our starting point, do we ever observe real world data randomness?
No.
Are we able to plug into a mathematical model?
No, we never observe randomness. I don't think it really exists, for one thing. Let me give you some the difference between what you do, the induction step, and then what you do with probability, the deductive step. You want to look at one die, then it has 6 outcomes. 1 to 6. As far as probability is concerned, I am perfectly happy to call the probability of any one of these numbers, I'll just call it PI. I don't care what it is. I do everything in probability just like that. I could care less whether it's 1/6, one of them might be 1/12. I don't care. Probability could care less. Statistics comes along and says, well, you need to do experimentation to see what this P really is. Because if we're really interested in a real world event, there's probability to care less. You don't care whether there's applications or not. When you want to go to applications, though, it's very important that you have a number for this. So you do experimentation, and you say, well, the probability of getting a 6 is approximately, say, 0.17. You've done experimentation, then you claim it's that. Fair died to be 1677 or something. This is the statistical thing. It gets back into the problem of the gases. You observe things, but that's limited. You can observe things which are only limited. You can only throw a dive so many times. What does that have to do about this actual P that really exists? Well, the best you can say is there's a certain amount of error. Every experiment you do, even if you take this table here, you can go and buy a million different devices to measure the length of it, and you can have people use each one of them, and there's going to be error involved. The best you can do is say, well, it's within such and such. So in terms of randomness, I think I prefer to use the term apparent randomness. Let me give you another example. If you want to look at, say, the strength of something, let's take a little fiber, strength of it. It's pretty well understood, assuming the molecular physics is right, it's pretty well understood how this fiber operates. But you can't go around using that type of detailed stuff to look at every single fiber, especially if you want to build a cable which may have 10,000 fibers in it. What you do is you test a few. You see that there's some regularity. You claim that that statistical regularity really represents the strength of this fiber, and then you use that inside the probability model. So this is a concept that's argued about a lot. People claim that this subjective stuff or the statistical probability actually is it. No questions about it. It's debated quite a bit, though.
Well, this whole area of randomness. Basically, what we're arguing about here in these sort of areas is on the assumption that there's a real world. I think everybody would agree to. And then the question is, what ultimately lies behind that real world? Is it a world of order, or is it a world finally random? And the answer is you really have to have all the data and be able to analyze it all to be able to tell that with certain words. Determinism would be a statement of whether something has a cause or not. And if everything has got a cause, then you would say we're in a deterministic universe, I guess. Okay. Yeah. You could, in principle, I suppose, have a partially deterministic universe. For instance, you could imagine a universe in which the motion perhaps of the particles was really random, but God intervened whenever he wanted to make sure that what he wanted to happen happened. And he could then tell you what's going to happen. Far better than we can on when we're driving a car, although we make predictions a half block in advance, hopefully, that we're going to turn right or left, or stop, things of that variety. But, of course, I lean towards a deterministic universe. So, that's it.
How like or unlike determinism is failure?
How like or unlike determinism is fatalism? Why don't you answer that?
Mr. Dunstwiler would do a much better job.
What do you mean by fatalism?
Well, I believe that's a common belief that everything is set to happen. There really isn't anything behind it that's going to happen anyhow.
There's one of the things that I found. Some guy tried to differentiate between different types of determinisms. Let's see if I can remember where I put this down. And he sort of gets at that point. At least he tries to make a definition. Yeah, this guy is a guy named Charles Hatfield who wrote an article that occurred in
Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation several years ago. He tried to distinguish between two types of determinism, which might be more what you're thinking of. One's metaphysical determinism, which he takes to mean that absolutely all events, including human thoughts and actions, result from universal laws. And then there's a methodological determinism, which is more of an attitude that seeks and even hopes for laws, but doesn't necessarily force every single detail to be absolutely determined. Now, I guess the thing that you might be wondering about is the question about man's responsibility. If you're a fatalist, then how can you blame man? Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure the scriptures tell you how, but they make it very clear that every man is responsible for some level, and whether or not that means it's metaphysical determinism or methodological determinism, I mean, those are in themselves models of what people observe in human nature. So you have to take the statements there. And I think the major problem with all of these things, which scientists really enjoy doing a lot, is they observe a certain thing for a period of time. Maybe it's a long period or a short period. And therefore, they want to make these sweeping generalizations about everything. And things just don't always work that way. You have to recognize that there are extenuating circumstances.
So if there's a result or coming to conclusion in this, I'd like to hear some comments on how this applies to apologetics. Am I correct in understanding that?
I haven't had that yet.
Yeah, well, it comes through a little bit. Can you say then that the only thing that you could prove, or use that word, about from observing the universe would be, say, in terms of this randomness, determinism question, is that it's possible to be deterministic. And it seems like it's saying that you can't prove it, it's not random, but you can say that it's possible that it's deterministic.
If you look purely from a scientific viewpoint, you cannot make a statement whether there is something that's inherently random or not. It just can't be done. What you can say is that no matter what you want to consider, it's conceivable that it is deterministic. So therefore, depending on your persuasion, some people want to make it everything random. Some people want to make it deterministic. So, let me just make one other comment to make sure I haven't knocked this modeling too much. Just because you can't determine absolute things about the scientific world, that isn't the same thing as saying you can't find out anything. For instance, when you're learning to drive, you know, you learn to hit the brakes at a certain point so that you stop at the intersection. Well, you practice that, and you know that in order for me to stop 500 feet ahead, I've got to apply a certain amount of pressure over a certain distance. So you learn certain facts. Whether or not you've learned exactly what it takes to stop you exactly at that point, and exactly how much pressure it is, that's a different question. Modeling certainly allows you to learn certain things. I don't think it allows you to learn every single possible thing.
Allows you to organize your experience, I think, is
yeah.
Very important. And yet all of us know that we don't know everything, and therefore we get surprised quite often. And that it's better to try and organize your experience than, because you can't know everything, never try to organize it. As the writer of Ecclesiastes says, at least the wise man, even though he dies the same as the fool does, at least he knows what he's doing most of his life. And I think there's a real balance to be said there.
I guess if you took the second law of thermodynamics, it's hard to know, too, how much randomness, or if there is any randomness, comparing whether it was always that way from creation, time zero, all the way through. It's hard to know.
hard to know if there was a change in structure of things at some particular time, maybe the flood, in which randomness was some way, the appearance of randomness occurred, and God working through history. It seems strange to me that God would zap certain events to happen. I guess it could do that, but somehow it seems like that's more of a, it's less of I would be much more happy with the thought that God is progressively working all the way through.
Well, if you zap enough events, it looks the same, doesn't it?
They don't appear the same. I guess they really will never.
And I don't know if it's easy to answer. This first verse in Proverbs 16 is very interesting. Unfortunately, it's been translated two drastically different ways on whether it's treated as the two lines are being antithetical or whether they're parallel. I haven't got a KJV here, but the KJV translates it as the plans of the heart in man and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. Everything is done by the Lord. Whereas the NASB and I think the NIV, etc., translated antithetically, the plans of the heart belong to man. But by the time it gets to any kind of action, the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. You get kind of a picture of a sphere within man where he's a creator or something like that. And then as soon as that begins to get into any kind of action event area, then God controls the actual outcome. I'm not sure I'd want to climb out of the limb and say that's the biblical picture of how things occur, but it's an interesting suggestion that would seem to be a partial determinism that retains the responsibility here. I don't know whether that's the right explanation.
One thing about determining things in the future and in the past, when you do statistical work, a lot of that is highly, highly speculative. Your the theories of time-dependent things, statistically speaking, is very, very crude. And it's easier to predict things in the future because then you can check them. But to try and predict things, what happened, that are gone forever, that's even more speculative.
For a period of time.
Yeah.
The calling a little more clear with the means your definition determined it.
Well, I didn't define it very well because I don't really know. See, the problem with this subject is it's gotten into the hands of the philosophers. Yes, mathematicians are basically philosophers anyhow. They've messed everything up. But basically, what I take as a definition of determinism is that all events are caused. There's something that causes everything to happen.
Is there any allowability for probability to determinism?
Some people think that there is.
Are you saying that everything has a cause and everything is cause and effect?
Some people think that there is room for that.
Is that what you're saying by determinism? That's what I'm trying to do.
Me personally?
Well, you define it, yeah.
Me personally, I would say that determinism does not allow any randomness.
But it might use a lot of probability.
Oh, that's a difference. That's something different. Using probability is a modeling tool, and that can be done even in places that we've demonstrated are purely deterministic. Using probability things that are purely deterministic, as much as we can determine, the probability as a tool for modeling is very, very useful. That's a different question than saying there's something inherently random in the thing. Those are...
It's the possibility in a random universe is meaningless. If you couldn't do possibility, what was
it? Well, I don't know. Probability is just a mathematical construct, so I don't care whether the universe is random or not. I go in my office and...
The goal of possibility is to predict the future and something's random.
You're saying by random, though, there's no prediction possible, which I don't think there are many people who believe the universe is basically random, believe there's no prediction possible. They believe that if you get down to a low enough level, prediction kind of fades out, and that's what the the persons who believe in Bohr and Heisenberg believe occurs in quantum mechanics. That on the large scale you can predict, but as you begin to get down to the very individual molecules and atoms, then all your prediction just goes up. You can't do anything anymore. Not individually. You can predict mass phenomena.
I haven't studied these people's, Bohr and Heisenberg's life very much, but an occurrence that has occurred frequently is the following situation where a fella wants to answer a question, like how does a hydrogen atom work? And he goes through and he comes up with this theory that he accepts purely as theory. Well, then somebody down the block sees that's his very exciting thing, and he goes up and he pats him on the back and says, that's a super job. Why won't you come and speak at our university? And then he presents it. He likes it a little better now that he's heard himself say it. And then maybe it even inflates to where he gets a Nobel Peace Prize, and now he's very popular. And now all of a sudden something that started out as purely theory has now become absolute fact. And he's oftentimes the person has gotten to a situation where he can't back down without losing a lot of prestige. So I'm not sure whether these people started out as having this randomness in there or not. If I were going to bet on it, I'd say no. But
then ultimately, if you have a big enough machine, you can predict everything. You're purely deterministic. And then there would be really no position for them. Free will would only be free will as observed on the surface. But really, it's completely lost. Which doesn't bother me, but I mean, it seems like that's what you're saying. Should I have a purely deterministic?
Two questions, I suppose, would be A. Is there such a thing as a first cause, which is not self-caused? Okay, in other words, can God do anything? And you can have a deterministic system in which still God acts according to his nature and his will, etc., but everything down below does not. Secondly, a Christian fellow named Donald Mackay, I think is his name, Clockwork Image, discusses a problem with free will determinism situation. And he says, when we talk about free will and we talk about determinism in a person's human decisions, we're often talking about a matter where the person, you say, could he have been able to do anything else in circumstance? And what you're really asking is, if he had known what would happen, could he have done anything else? And he says, when you put in, if he had known what would have happened, you have in fact changed his brain state, and that might have influenced the decision. So he tries to work from, I think, a pretty deterministic point of view. I'm not sure I'm satisfied with a lot of things he comes up with, but a very clever discussion of the whole free will determinism situation on the basis that when you add this additional information to the person that he knows what decision he's going to make, that is going to change his brain state. He might not make that same decision. It's very clever. The Clockwork Image by Donald Mackay, I think it is, published by InterVarsity.
In determinism, is there any saying that something has a cause? Is there any way to distinguish between a deist type of universe where God started it off, set up the laws, and then let it kind of crank out, and the type of universe that Wally mentioned where God is working in and throughout, controlling, moving, acting, sustaining? Both of those things are caused, both are determined, but there's a large difference between the type of concept that you're working on.
I don't know whether you can construct a scientific experiment to test it or not.
No, but I'm saying in your personal deterministic view, which way would you...
In mine?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd never take the deistic viewpoint. And the scriptures make that perfectly clear that that doesn't occur.
So you take the position that God is in every event controlling
everything? Oh, sure.
And molecular as well as...
So
well, you know, I hate to push it to the molecular level. That's so vague, but, you know, if you ask me out in the hall, I'll say yes. Yeah, because when you consider this definition by Parson that I gave, who's a very well-respected probabilist, an event that's random by that definition is a miracle. You look and see what a miracle is, then it's a random event. Well, you go through and look at all the miracles that occur. Taylor, in that little article that he wrote, he went through, where's the one where the, somewhere in 1 Kings where the guy shoots the arrow and it hits, Ahab. What is that? 2 Chronicles. On the surface, this guy shoots an arrow and Ahab has all of his armor on, and yet the arrow just happens to snake its way in between to kill him. Well, on the surface, and in fact, I think the word, at least in the King James there, it said it happened, and it sort of, it doesn't say at random, but it implies it was a chance occurrence, quote. But when you look at the context, it makes it very clear that all of that was set up to happen. So what appears as a random event according to this definition really is nothing but a miracle which was determined by God.
In fact, you regularly have a common parlance use the term random, chance, etc., which you mentioned earlier, which is, by the way, used in science as well for a statement of something, the outcome you did not expect or were not able to predict. May not mean it's random at all. It just means that within the range of your knowledge, well, as far as the guy who was drawing the bow knew, he wasn't aiming at the king, okay? He was aiming at this other guy, really. Or he may not have been aiming at anybody. He might have just been getting rid of his arrow as a quota he needed to get off to get his cut of the pay or something. But, well, same as the Good Samaritan parable. By chance, the fellow came along the same way. Well, it means that guy didn't plan to come along when this guy was lying there. It doesn't mean God didn't know what was going to happen.
Part of the problem with all of this discussion is the way the terms are used. Scientists abuse the terms just as much as anybody else. And that's part of the real problem, what you mean by the terms. That's why I wanted to make it clear that probability and random from that self and from that setup is a mathematical construct. That's all there is to it. So the way you look at these words in terms of other things have to be considered that way.
I'm trying to figure out something in terms of the problem of evil, okay? And one of the classic answers to the problem of evil is that God chose the world, one of the best possible worlds that would lead to the most good happening, okay? I don't know if you agree with that, but that's the planting of free will event, if I remember correctly. So, in terms of the definition that you said of God sustaining, okay, it almost makes God the chargeable cause of the evil happening. And that's something I'm trying to work with.
First of all, who's to say that he had to choose? I mean, who's to say that he had a choice out of all these possible worlds? I don't understand exactly what you're...
I guess philosophically that's just one of the answers. That's why evil happens, because God is allowing this much evil to happen, because that much evil will actually promote this much more good, and so God chose this world for that reason. Even though there is this evil happening, its final end is always to be.
Okay, but in terms of the evil question, I mean, the scriptures make it very clear that God allows certain evil to take place, but he controls it, and he's not the blameworthy cause.
Yeah, that's the jump line.
Okay, so...
I wonder about. See, because if you can prevent something, say somebody runs in this room and shoots you, but I can prevent that person from doing it, but I don't. I let that person run in the room and shoot you. In some senses, I'm to blame because I didn't prevent that evil from happening. Okay, I know the scriptures say that God could prevent it. He does not, but he's not blamable. But I'm trying to grapple with that in terms of the fact that if everything is determined, he is controlling and sustaining. Well, that's the classic answer, but...
What's wrong with the classic answer?
See, the problem, well, one thing, I haven't...
He's praiseworthy. We don't know what we call praise.
Is there any real who?
Real evil.
Well, I think the Bible gives us pretty good warning is real evil.
I agree.
I do think that the... This is way off the subject of deterministic probability. I see what you mean. Except that if deterministic universe, then God... I personally think, from the base of several scriptural passages we've got, that God has a different purpose for certain things that happen than the purposes that the people have who do them. So, for instance, David numbers the children of Israel. His purpose, apparently pride and a desire for security and checking the size of his army, his available draft pool or something like that. Satan caused him to number the people. Satan's purpose was to get David to disobey the commandment so that he would get it or something like that. Another passage says God caused him to number the people. And, of course, we also know that David didn't number anyway. So there were some guys who beat on the doors and got the numbers, etc. But what you see is a chain of causality. I think we have to say that each of those people supplied something to what occurred. And my understanding of the matter would be that man is a creator of the moral quality of the actions he produces. That God is doing the action for good, and all the good that comes out of it, he has caused that to happen because a bunch of the other guys down the chain were working evil. They are the causes of whatever evil they supply to that incident, because a person dying is not itself necessarily an evil, though it was not what man was designed to be originally. Well, for a believer, it's not an evil. For an unbeliever, you might say it's an evil, but if the rest of his life he is only going to commit more sins, then he's actually been saved from quite a bit of punishment because he died at that point. Though the act itself is a bad thing, then he was not designed that way. So my speculation would be that the evil that inheres in men's acts has been put there either by themselves or by Satan or various other false opportunities. It's not been put there by God. Well, I think that fits with the Proverbs 16:1 passage. The plans of the heart of man belong, the plans in the heart belong to, but the remark of the lips, I'm watching the passage already.
From the Lord comes the reply of the tongue.
But the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. The event that actually occurs. Yeah, now God is clever enough, he may be able to do most of those through events that look very probable.
Yeah.
But rather than events that look very improbable. So, we're getting into things we really don't know much about, you understand that. But forced to try and answer certain things that are brought up as objections.
There's a lot of places, though, that are similar to that David example.
Oh, yes. Joseph. The atonement, even, is... there's another... But the atonement, the Son of Man goes as is written of him, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed. Judas had moral responsibility for the betrayal, though God is going to bring good out of it. Joseph is certainly a good example.
Habakkuk, when the Chaldeans attack?
Yeah. Isaiah 10. The Assyrians used by God to judge Israel, but morally responsible, because that's not their intention. Complicated.
Here's a practical question then. Why don't we still use lots today? I mean, when I think of Achan, you know, I can imagine Achan sitting back there saying, oh boy, they're never going to find me. I mean, the chances of thousands and thousands of one, and sure enough, all of a sudden keeps going down, his tribe, his family, his father. You know, and so, why don't we still do that today?
As a matter of fact, there are people that do.
Are there people listening?
Yes.
That's one reason why I love the others don't. They don't believe that God is providing that form of guidance, but you're welcome to try if you'd like to see.
Yeah, it might end up on the edge. And then,
I think the answer to that question is that the scripture is complete. When the church began, God worked miracles. But then, as time went on, he allows people's mistakes and errors to cause that North Africa, which was one of the greatest Christian areas of the whole world, became another desert as far as Christianity. That is to say, he does not intervene in that miraculous way to protect it in one section. He protected the little force until it became a big force, and then he leaves human attitudes to affect it in various areas. And the same is true of guidance, that God guided very desperately while the scripture was being presented and brought the supernatural leadership of people for the production of the scripture and for the preparation of that which is our complete guide. And then from there on, we have the scripture to study and learn the principles he wanted to apply. And then he expects us to apply those principles and do our best to find the correct answer. And then pray to him if we made a mistake to overrule and go ahead with the best judgment we can get using the best judgment from the scripture. But we have no right to expect him to intervene in a miraculous way today. And yet we cannot rule out the possibility that he may choose to.
Even in the places in the scripture where it talks about casting lots, by the way, all of those events were completely determined, the outcomes.
I did that once myself. I was at a burning point where I felt I knew what the Lord wanted me to do. And yet I had an offer to a very attractive, which wouldn't interfere eventually with going the way I thought the Lord wanted me to, but which might be a nice side pass for a brief time, which might be valuable in preparation later. And I was confronted with this, and I had to make a decision, and I didn't know how to make it. And I said, Lord, if you're willing to give me some guidance on this, to stoop to my weakness, well, I said, I will take two coins, and I will say that if I throw these two coins up in the air, the chances are 1 in 4 that they will come up in one way. So I say there are 3 chances out of 4. That there will be no guidance. That you don't choose to give guidance this way. There'll be 1 chance in 4 that you're going to stoop to my weakness and give me the indication that that which I have previously intended is the path I should go. And I threw the coins and they came the way I said. Well, then I said, now, let's suppose that this is pure accident. Let's try it again. And have it be that this one comes down heads and this other one comes down tail. If you give me guidance, and if it happens any of the other 3 ways, you're not giving me any guidance, and it came that way. And then I said differently, and it came the third way. And then I flipped 1 coin and said heads or tails, and it came. Well, now, humanly speaking, the probability of that is very, very slight. And I believe the way I went was the way the Lord wanted me to go, and I don't think that gave me any reason to feel that I should ever use that procedure again. But it seems to me that in that particular situation, you can make a pretty strong argument that God did lead to the coin. But not say, if this way, that proves this, and the other that, but 1 chance in 4 rather than 1 or 2. Yeah. I only do that once in my life.
This has been a presentation of IBRI, the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. For more information or a free copy of our catalog, please write to